From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, a magazine profile looks for untold angles to Scott Walker's first term as governor.
The nature of daily news is there are always things that kind of get overlooked because you're always writing based on around a news peg. There are some of the broader storylines you can't quite get your arms around.
Later, a photography project tells the story of Wisconsin's oldest family-run businesses.
There was some sort of a feeling of history that I felt I had to do, and I was concerned. I still am concerned for these businesses.
We'll talk about kids and vegetable gardens, and the poetry of Wisconsin native Aaron Larandos. Lake Effect comes your way next after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Great to have you listening on this Friday morning. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker was included this week in Time Magazine's list of 100 most influential Americans. The essay about him was written by New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who, like Walker, is thought to be mulling a presidential run. Christie praised what he termed as Walker's, quote, common sense reform of the public sector collective bargaining laws. Of course, that notion is debated by many across the country and here in Wisconsin in particular. A feature in the upcoming issue of Milwaukee Magazine tries to shed some additional light on Scott Walker's first term in office as he gears up for his reelection campaign. It's written by Matt Rohde, who joins us in the studio now. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks. Glad to be here.
So this is kind of a daunting task, a profile of Governor Scott Walker, considering at this point you would be hard-pressed to find anyone in the state without a pretty well-formed opinion of him. Was there an untold story you were trying to get at in covering this story?
We weren't sure exactly what it would be, so we just started talking to people who were coming at it from a number of different perspectives. And the nature of daily news is there are always things that kind of get overlooked because you're always writing based on around a news peg. There are some of the broader storylines you can't quite get your arms around. So we kind of started looking for what some of those were, and some of the stuff ended up being a little more wonky than something you might see as the basis for a news story in a newspaper. So we kind of came at things as far out as left field as we could and to see what we came up with.
So this is one of those cases where instead of having a really well-defined through line at the start of the process, you went out and accumulated as much as you could and then tried to figure out what the through line was?
Right. Only thing we knew going in was that we wanted to do some kind of a profile of the governor. We've thought about doing it for a while, but it's been even before the recall, and we weren't sure about the timing. And this seemed about as good of a time as there was as is going to present itself.
Well, and you point out in the article you made repeated efforts to interview Scott Walker himself, but without success.
We ended up getting from a lower-level spokesperson a few comments by email, and there were a couple funny paragraph breaks, and the font was like 16-point. It almost looked like something that had been pecked out on a smartphone, which isn't to say that his media operation is necessarily duct tape and bubble gum. But he sort of wasn't interested. He's very strategic with media, and that's something he's always been really capable at is using TV especially to serve himself up on a platter.
Right. I think you write about you spoke with Mordecai Lee, the political analyst in town, former Democratic state legislator. I think he was recalling being a panelist alongside Scott Walker fairly early on the Mark Belling show and saying that Scott Walker in that role was already pretty ready for media at that point.
Right. And he was doing it not exactly the same way he does now. He was very sort of placating. Most of the issues that came up, he found himself inevitably on the same side as Mark Belling and the show Belling and Company. And then Lee was sort of surprised this would happen every time. But he would sort of spin things in a warmer and fuzzier light. And Lee gave the example of before Walker was even elected, he said that he would oppose taking federal money to build a high-speed rail line from Milwaukee to Madison. And he didn't use words like boondoggle or this is, wasteful spending. he gave you this sort of technocrat answer of, well, you know, down the line, it's going to cost so many millions to upkeep. And in the past, the federal government has reneged on certain promises and this and that. And so he was giving these kind of nicer, gentler explanations for something that someone else might have been more draconian about.
As though he was trying not to be polarizing in a way. But at the same time, I mean, you make the point, and a lot of people have made the point, that his governorship has been incredibly polarizing.
Yeah, he can't have done what he's done without being polarizing. He seems to have weathered it so well. By the middle of 2011, his approval rating was really – I mean, it dipped for a little bit below 40%. But he came back pretty fast. And by the time the recall actually happened, he had rehabilitated himself remarkably quickly.
Well, and in fact, one of the – going back to your point about how you were trying to do things that might not be covered in a day-to-day sort of news story sort of way, one of the points that you make – the story of Act 10, of course, has been told quite a bit. But you make this interesting analogy between how he rode out the political storm over that legislation and how more recently he emerged pretty unscathed from the release of those thousands of pages of documents related to the John Doe investigation. What were the similarities you found?
Part of it was to not stop traveling and to never isolate himself, to never physically isolate himself. And in the book that he put out, Unintimidated, he talks about when things would get tough in Madison, he would head out and he went on a hangar tour. And it ended up being, the day of or the day before that the state Senate passed Act 10, what became Act 10.
In a similar way, when the day that the 27,000 pages of documents came out, you kind of chart his movement across the states.
Right. Yeah, for that a good week or two after that, he was just door to door, event to event. I don't know how many untold number of manufacturing facilities he toured, and the guy just kind of never stops. And he tends to aggress when tough questions like that are being asked. He tends to confront them directly and give some kind of answer. And what happens is you might have a negative story or two, but then the questions stop. Once a beat reporter has dealt with an issue like that, he's looking for a new one. You know, the editor is like, well, we reported on that last week.
You mentioned Unintimidated, the memoir, the ghostwritten memoir about his first term in office. Did you see that book as kind of being a stand-in for being able to interview the man himself?
It was certainly helpful. It's a better read than you might think it is going to be. It's a lot of – and just about every page makes some kind of reference to the bold reforms he made, which refers to Act 10, and it's 250-some pages of spin. He had a pretty strong ghostwriter, Mark Moranis, I believe. So it's kind of a lighter read than you might expect, and it gave some insight into some scenes that might not have had otherwise, one of which was the actual writing of the bill that started out as Act 10. And
Nuclear light, I think.
Right.
Was the,
right. He had sort of dreamed, and he had gotten some counsel from some people outside of Wisconsin, such as Mitch Daniels, who had repealed public bargaining.
This is the governor of Indiana.
For collective bargaining for public employees in Indiana. And he had an idea, and legislature leaders in the state legislature said, this is just too extreme. So they came up with a nuclear light version. And there's a scene where the Fitzgerald brothers and Mike Ellis and Alberta Darling and Robert Voss were literally standing around a computer typing out the nuclear light version.
You also spoke with a Democratic state senator who was a freshman in the assembly at the same time Scott Walker was first elected. How did Tim Carpenter view the legislator that Scott Walker was and the governor he became?
They were sort of friends when they were both in the state assembly. They literally sat across the aisle from each other, would talk about the Brewers and their kind of young guys coming up out of the Milwaukee area. And according to him, he's seen Walker become more and more polarized. And if you look at him from sort of a Walker from a numbers and a dollars viewpoint, his ability to raise millions and millions of dollars has ballooned. And part of that formula seems to have been what Carpenter is commenting on, that he's more partisan and effectively more polarizing because he puts out strong viewpoints and sticks to them, which is pretty effective for raising money, especially outside of the state.
You also spoke with people on the Republican side of the aisle, including a former fairly popular Republican governor. How does Tommy Thompson view the Walker administration?
I mean, when Walker was a young state rep, Walker was a little bit of a protege. I mean, he was somebody that Thompson and other leaders had identified was someone who's talented and could rise fast. And Thompson's, you know, is mindful of his own legacy as governor. And I even got the sense he was a little bit jealous of the attention that Walker is getting, that he's being considered so seriously as a possible presidential candidate.
Right. We forget that Tommy Thompson had the same ambitions, and they really never got off the dime.
Right. And Thompson sort of jokes about that today. In 2008, he kind of flamed out in Iowa. Or it wasn't even really a flame out. He just kind of stumbled in Iowa, and that was it. He's a little bit jealous, and we saw this when Thompson ran for U.S. Senate, that he's trying to depict his record as being maybe a bit more conservative than it was. And some of the experts I spoke to did describe Thompson's some of his early budgets as fiscally conservative in a way that Walker might also consider fiscally conservative.
Well, speaking of political ambitions, you kind of close this piece with people's thoughts about the potential that Scott Walker has in terms of a run for president. What do people generally think? You mainly hear from Republicans on this. They sounded a little bit torn about whether he really has promise as far as running for president goes.
He has to win in Wisconsin first, and what's enabled him to. What's, you know, has been his passport onto the national stage is the union fight, first of all, and then continuing to be sort of a polarizing, very almost strong-arming sort of political figure. And that's why people are talking about him as a possible presidential contender, because he pulls in lots of money. Lots of people are excited, and he seems to be a very talented and sort of a juggernaut politician. The downside is that he has to win in Wisconsin first, and he has a lot of enemies in Wisconsin because of that political style. And if he doesn't win in Wisconsin, then that kind of knocks him off his perch and he's not going to be able to run for president in that case.
Did you get any sense from anyone you talked to about whether he's talked with them about whether he might run for president?
Wisconsin Republicans, it's not something he talks with very many people about. I'm sure there are a couple of people within his campaign that he's open with, but that seems to be about it. Wisconsin, it's kind of a non-issue. It doesn't come up. It's a little bit taboo, it seemed. Republicans in Wisconsin don't seem to be asking him, you know. They don't seem interested in forcing the question. And so everybody is kind of watching and waiting. And I would imagine my own personal guess is that he hasn't decided, but he's leaving as many doors open as he can.
To be continued. Matt Rohde, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Matt Rohde is associate editor at Milwaukee Magazine. His article on Governor Scott Walker is in the May issue, which is on its way to subscribers now and on newsstands next week. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio, 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. We're on into the fourth day of our Spring Into Action Spring Membership Drive with an overall goal of $130,000. But Bonnie North, who joins us in the studio right now, we have a much more immediately makeable goal anyway.
We certainly do. $700 for this hour of Lake Effect, and that is imminently doable. The only thing you have to do is call 414-227-3210 or go to the website wuwm.com/give. And consider what WUWM and its programming means to you. What is it worth to you? Perhaps it's a $100 gift. Perhaps it's a $1,000 gift. Perhaps it's somewhere in between. What's important is that you step up and you spring into action and you become an active member or renew that active membership if it's about time for that to happen. So we have some things to entice you with that, including this wonderful thank you gift, Mitch. It's a great travel mug.
Right. It's a 17-ounce travel mug we call it a tumbler. It's stainless steel and has the WUWM logo on it. It's insulated. It'll keep your cold drink cold this summer. It'll keep your warm drink warm this coming winter or in the summer for those of you who drink warm beverages in the summer. At any rate, it's yours when you make a contribution at the $60 level or at the sustaining level of $5 a month or $15 a quarter. That's the WUWM WWM travel Tumblr.
Tumblr, I think it has no handle, which
that's
is
a good, that's, I think that's
that's
right.
The point. And of course, if you can give more than the $5 a month, we would welcome that, but that is the absolute bottom for that. But anyone who contributes during this drive is included in a drawing for a dinner for two at the Michelin-starred Moto restaurant in Chicago. That includes a farm tour and a lab cooking class, so don't forget that either.
414-227-3210 or WUWM.com/give. A new book and photo exhibit at the Museum of Wisconsin Art looks at some of the state's longest-standing family businesses. We'll chat with a photographer when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. Not long ago, one of the area's oldest hardware stores in Wauwatosa Village closed its doors for good. The family-owned shop occupied a space that had been a hardware store for more than a century. But the Milwaukee area and Wisconsin as a whole are still home to many long-standing family-owned businesses. And in fact, in some small communities, they are what make the business district distinctive. Photographer Carl Corey set out to capture the essence of some of the state's family-owned businesses that have been around for 50 years or more. The result is a new book called For Love and Money and an exhibit just opened at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend. Corey joined us recently via Skype from Hudson, Wisconsin. Thanks for being with us.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Mitch.
Is there an overriding story you are trying to tell through these photographs?
The one thing that's important to me is that I really don't try and tell anything. I try and share and observe things. And I like people to be able to interact with the photographs or the book, book of photographs, but and derive their own conclusion. Obviously, as a photographer, what I choose to put in the camera is based upon my impressions and my selection. So there is that control, but I don't really like to be too heavy-handed and say, I don't like to have a conclusive photograph. Let's put it that way.
The guiding principle behind all the photographs is these are all long-standing businesses in this state, and often their owners, but not always their owners in these pictures. And while there's that kind of overarching connection, it seems like it would be wrong to assume that they are all necessarily alike in all ways.
No, they're not. They're not. They're alike in the fact that they're family businesses of 50 plus years. But they're as different as people are, or families are, and businesses are. I mean, different families, different backgrounds, different amount of family members, different size of the business. Retail, wholesale, manufacturing, service industry. There's all sorts of different businesses that I photographed for this. And it, like you said, the only real underlying factor is the fact that they are family owned and they've been in business for 50 plus years. I even photographed a fella who's actually works on one of my tractors up in River Falls, and his business has been himself. It's just been him for 50 years, but it's been 50 years of him, and of course his wife is involved as by being his wife, and his son has taken actually over the business, but it was really just Dick Bierstedt that was the person involved in that as a heavy equipment mechanic. So, and then I photographed places like Superior, Lidgerwood, Mundy up in Superior that, employ, close to 100 people at times and do big, heavy shipping and cabling, spooling type industry up to Great Lakes. So it's there's just different businesses.
How long do you spend in each of these places and with these people before you're comfortable with being, I guess, comfortable with depicting what you see?
Well, you want to know how the process went, how I selected where to go?
Yeah, absolutely.
I sent out close to 200 contacts to local chambers of commerce around the state. Quite frankly, the hardest thing about this for me is, I'm a photographer, so the photography comes naturally, but the hardest thing is the logistics. Where are these people? Who are these people? Who's been in business 50 plus years? And the results in the book and in the entire series, there's a lot more photographs than are in the book, of course. There's, sure. There's limited room in a book. The results are from those chambers of commerce and business, you know, institutions that had responded to the to my requests. A lot did not. Surprisingly, I was really surprised that a lot just totally ignored the request. And so that's how I found who participated in the book. And what I would then do is send them a contact, a letter or email. I never really called cold. I would always, do it in writing. And then if they were interested, I would follow up with, a phone call, make an appointment, make a phone call. And then, we'd schedule a time for me to come visit and meet them. So it was a long process. It wasn't like a guy with the camera walking down the main street of town looking for old businesses. There was a real lot of legwork up front, Mitch. And I'm very thankful to the people in the book for making themselves available, in the series, for making themselves available, as well as those chambers of commerce that assisted me in finding these folks.
Well, and once you got to these places, I mean, you weren't a tourist. You didn't just walk in and take a couple of pictures and leave. How long did you typically stay to get a sense for accurately depicting, the image you wanted to?
Usually I go in ahead of time and kind of introduce myself, that I'm Carl, and this is what's going on, and it's nice to meet you. Thanks for doing it. And come back the next day. And in terms of time, it varied from business to business. Obviously, a bigger business took more time than a smaller business. But I would say the average amount of time I spent with each business was about an hour.
Do you think the longevity of these businesses play on the minds of the people that you photographed? They are obviously in these jobs to make a living, not necessarily to preserve history, but at the same time, they can't exactly ignore the history either.
Well, their sense of pride runs pretty deep, and justifiably. It's very difficult to be a business person in today's environment, and it's even more difficult to be a business person for that length of time. And anyone that's had a family business for 50 plus years, we can say is very successful, probably more successful than most of the banking industry. And, in the auto industry and such. I mean, everyone looks at those big businesses as being so successful, but really how many times have they needed to be bailed out or claimed, bankruptcy, et cetera. And that just doesn't happen with a small family run business. You got one chance, one shot. And so I really applaud these people. And they are proud. They're very proud of what they do. They're not arrogant. It's not an arrogance. It's just a pride. And it's very deserved. I really have a lot of respect for them.
Do you think they're able to survive and succeed today because of things like globalization and the internet or despite it?
Despite. I really have to say despite. It's getting more and more difficult for businesses to survive in the face of the big box store and Amazon and the internet. It's a struggle for them. But what they have is that service. And they can, you can walk in, from the retail businesses have the hardest time, but you can walk into one of these retail businesses and they'll help you. They'll assist you, and there's that personal service that you're not going to get anywhere else but from a small business. You're not going to get it in a big box store. You're not going to get it in off the internet, of course. It's really an experience. And while things have to cost a little bit more because of the volume, I mean, these people have to survive and they pay more, I think it's well worth it to support them and to visit those stores. I think you get the value for the money.
At the same time, I gather at least one of the businesses you were working with actually closed up while you were in the process of compiling the projects.
Yeah. It was in Marinette. It was Globe House Furnishings, which, if my memory suits me correctly, was established in 1888. And the picture, it was actually the first picture that I did specifically for this book, and it was the pictures of Mary McCarrier, the owner, holding a portrait of the founder. Her grandfather or great-grandfather, and they had just liquidated all their inventory and sold it and are closing down the store after, how many years, 140 years or so. And it was in light of the fact that they just could not compete as a furniture retailer against the big box stores. But what was really, they weren't upset. She was actually relieved. She said she's just glad that they're relieved that it'll be over and they'll be fine. But her main concern, it struck me very It'll always be with me. Her main concern was for her vendors, the people that sold to her, because they're losing their customers. The traveling salesmen that go from furniture store to furniture store to show their line that they represent or the lines that they represent are losing clients. They're losing their customers. And that was Mary's concern. And I thought that really pointed out the type of people that these folks are.
And you said that this was actually the first picture you took for this project. I wonder if that made the rest of the project seem all the more urgent to you.
It did. Yeah, I never really thought of it till you just mentioned that, Mitch. But it really did. There was some sort of a feeling of history that I felt I had to do, and I was concerned. I still am concerned for these businesses. I'm concerned that they're not going to be able to survive. But I didn't want it to be a melancholy project either. And I didn't want to, there's so many projects about, the demise of this, that, and the other, of the small business or the demise of Detroit, very few people are showing the good side of Detroit. There's a lot of people that focus on the negative, and I did not want to do that. I did not want to focus on the negative aspects. I wanted to support these people. I wanted to share with people that see the photographs just how important these businesses are to our communities.
I feel like we talked about this with your previous book on taverns. The people in your photographs are very conspicuously not smiling, but they're also obviously posing for these pictures. Is it a challenge to capture a subject in a staged way in which their face isn't necessarily telling the story? We expect to see emotion in people's faces, and the people in your pictures are not necessarily showing emotion, but their faces don't tell the story.
No, I think basically, my whole life as a photographer, I've had a philosophy about smiling for the camera, and it is definitely a staged emotion. I mean, everyone feels they need to smile for a camera because that's what's expected. I wanted these people to be distilled, if you will, to as base an element of them as a human being as could be. I do think that there is a sense of pride that comes through in the photographs. And in order for an environmental portrait to succeed, I think it's very important that you see a lot of the environment, which is why they're placed, relatively small in the environment. I think it makes it much more interesting for people to see where these people work, or for the viewer to see where these people work, where the subjects work.
There are a couple of photos I think make for a really interesting contrast. In one, you picture the proprietors of a furniture store in Kiel, and you took the picture through the plate glass window with them inside the front display. And a few pages later, we see the owners of a resort in Phelps, and you as the photographer are in the guest room and the owners are peering in the window.
Yeah. Well, I try to make, visual interest. As a photographer, I also have a responsibility that there's some visual interest in the pictures. And so I like to use those as visual elements, frames, and, graphic visual elements. And that's really why. I also enjoyed putting the folks at Meiselwitz Furniture inside their showroom, like they're on view. This is their business. And it's actually one of my more favorite photographs in the series. And then I think the other one you're talking about is Afterglow Resort.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to be able to show the room and view out the window of the room because it's, obviously that resort relies upon its environment for success, the North Woods, the getaway. And I wanted to include that in the portrait of the owners.
I'm curious, are you influenced at all by Edward Hopper's Nighthawks painting? There is a certain composition and a certain lighting in several of these photographs that's reminiscent of that painting. It sort of, I don't know whether it's the mood or it's the kind of yellow tones that are lighting it up, but it comes through.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, specifically that painting, which I, obviously everyone knows pretty well. Yeah, I mean, I can see that painting right now. They brought it up in my mind. It's beautiful. It's a wonderful piece. And the thing about Hopper is that he was a documentarian of sorts, but with the paintbrush rather than the camera. I guess I'm influenced a lot by, all of us, all artists are kind of influenced by their past and by those that preceded them. And it would be hard for me to say that somehow, some way, Hopper's work didn't have some influence upon me. as an artist. But I'm also influenced by people as vernacular as William Eggleston and as, you know, classic as Dorothea Lange and Margaret Burke White. And, you know, one of my very favorites is Walker Evans. And so, you know, yeah, but you're right. And I'm a color photographer, and that is, you know, color plays a very important role in the pictures to me.
Do you feel, after having taken images in so many of these places, a sense of duty to return to any of them, or just be aware of where you're shopping and who you're doing business with?
Well, you know, none of them are really in my community. My community didn't respond. And while they're in my state, they're not convenient for me at all to shop to. However, we have a lot of book signing events in these communities, Keele, Marinette, Milwaukee, I'll be in Madison, La Crosse. So I am returning in that aspect. But for me personally to shop at them, it's totally impractical. I mean, they're not close to me.
Well, Carl Corey, it is a remarkable collection of photographs. Thank you so much for helping share the story.
Oh, thanks, Mitch. I appreciate your interest.
Photographer Carl Corey's new book is called For Love and Money, Portraits of Wisconsin Family Businesses. An exhibit of photos from the project is on display at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend. We spoke to him via Skype from Hudson, Wisconsin. You're listening to Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. It's day four of our Spring Into Action membership drive. Bonnie North joins us. What is our goal this hour?
Our goal this hour is $700, and we are well on our way to making that thanks to your generosity. Lots of folks have gone to WUWM.com/give and made a donation that way. It's secure and safe. You can also call 414-227-3210 and make your contribution that way. The important thing is that you actually make the contribution. You become an active member of listener-supported Milwaukee Public Radio, because that's exactly what makes everything happen here, is your generosity. 414-227-3210, WUWM.com/give.
Getting kids involved in the business, or at least the fun, of growing vegetables. That story when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. The temperature in Wisconsin, at least southeastern Wisconsin, has consistently stayed above freezing, more or less, for a while now. We've had some occasional rain and some occasional sun, so it's looking pretty good to get into the business of growing things. But if your growing plans involve the people growing up in your household as well, our outdoor adventure contributors have some suggestions. Stacy Tornio and Ken Keffer are authors of We Love Nature and the Kids Outdoor Adventure book, and they join us now to talk about involving kids in growing food. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having us.
We are finally into the point where we can probably safely start to grow things in our gardens. And so let's talk about, you know, maybe the entree into the gardening world, growing food and involving your kids in growing that food.
Yeah, so kind of the typical veggies that people grow, especially in Wisconsin, are tomatoes and peppers, and it's kind of the standard ones that people try. But kids, like, if you let them loose on a seed aisle, they will start picking things that you never dreamed of growing. You know, they're going to be picking, like, purple carrots and striped beans and really cool-looking peas and all this stuff that, you know, we kind of don't think about. But kids are like, I want to do that. I want to grow that. And that excitement, if they have that excitement, encourage that. You know, buy that seed packet and let them give it a try.
And presumably, if it's in the seed aisle in a store in Wisconsin, the store has hopefully done its homework enough so that these are things that can grow here.
I hope so.
Indeed. Yeah. You know, I think the thing about Wisconsin gardening is we have to start a little bit later, but we still have a long enough growing season that we can grow a lot of different varieties of things. You know, you're just not quite as early as some of those others. And you might lose something later in the season, but, you know, yeah, I mean, go ahead and give it a try. And that's part of gardening, too, is not everything you plant grows, even if it's the perfect variety.
Well, and along those lines, kids, even really good kids, are not always great as far as attention span goes. Or, you know, they'll plant something and you know, they'll go out and check it religiously in day one, two, three, four. By the time day 13 comes and there's nothing coming out of the ground,
they're done.
Yeah. So let's talk about what realistically is the kind of thing that, you know, might have at least, if not an immediate food payoff, an immediate relatively quick payoff in terms of stuff coming out of the ground.
Okay. So I've done a lot of gardening with my kids, and I know exactly what you're talking about. They're like, okay, where's my stuff? Why isn't it here yet? So some of the fastest things that you're going to get are peas. Carrots have a relatively short growing time. All the lettuces are really good for kids. But don't be afraid to like try it with the seeds because that's your cheapest option. If the seeds fail and they don't come up good, move on. Like, you know, go to your garden center and buy plants. Like, they're not that expensive. Put plants into the ground so then the kids have something. And then beyond that, I always say make a calendar. You know, show the kids on that seed packet that, okay, it's going to be 60 days or 70 days or 90 days till harvest time. And make sure that they know that they're still involved. Like, they have to water that plant. It needs sunshine. And it's still part of the process. So make a little calendar for them. Mark your little watering days on which days they have to go out there and go from there.
Another great thing for kids is herbs. You know, that's something that you go out there, you can pluck a leaf or two there, eat that, you know, basil, cilantro. Stacy's son Jack is a huge cilantro guy, so he's out there popping cilantro bits, you know, and so that kind of helps encourage, like, hey, I'm going to go out there, get a little snack, maybe I'll thin the carrots down. Carrots are a lot of fun with kids because you can start by throwing a bunch in there, and then you're plucking, and you get little itty-bitty tiny little carrot sprouts, you know, and so they might try and get a little nibble of that.
I have to point out that these are not baby carrots.
These are not the baby carrots, exactly. This is, indeed.
And then last year we did potatoes. And potatoes, they're a little bit different. You need to buy those in a bag. And you're buying those they look like potatoes, like cut up potatoes. And we actually grew ours in a box, didn't we?
Yeah, we'll be honest though, we did that for me and not for the kids. I was like, oh, we can grow something in a cardboard box?
Okay, so how do you grow potatoes in a box?
It's just like it sounds. You take a cardboard box, you throw some soil in there, you put the potatoes in there, and then bam, they grow. And it's like this big, you know, growth coming out of the box. You water it, it gets a little soggy, but you know, a cardboard box will hold up for an entire growing season.
Right, for potatoes.
It's like a raised bed, only cardboard.
Yeah. You can grow them in your driveway.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's awesome. And then the potatoes, you just dig in. You know, you have to dig all that up. And so the cardboard box is destroyed. It's like, who cares? That's so much fun.
Full-size potatoes?
Yeah.
You can. I mean, you're not going to do potatoes in a shoebox. You might be able to grow some carrots in a shoebox. But we're talking, you know, a pretty good-sized box. But, yeah, we tried it out last year, and it worked wonderfully.
This is like a little slice of Idaho, courtesy of maybe U-Haul.
Right.
Get a big refrigerator box worth of potatoes.
Oh,
now we're talking.
Well, what about in terms of hardiness? Because, you know, I would imagine that – I wouldn't have to imagine this. Kids are going to be disappointed if they plant something that takes a real amount of finesse to be able to pull off. What are the maybe more foolproof things to grow that aren't going to die if you forget to water them one afternoon?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of veggies are pretty resilient. The peas for kids, really easy. Beans for kids are really easy. Even tomatoes, you know, they're pretty drought tolerant if you at least forget it. I mean, you can't forget it for days and days and days, but it's pretty flexible as far as being able to miss a day or two for kids. And again, like, don't be afraid to buy plants. Like, seeds, I always recommend seeds because it's cost effective. It's fun to see the process from seed to plant. But if you have a kid that just isn't intrigued or really needs more immediate results, go to the garden store and buy the plant. You can get great deals in June after everybody has already planted their vegetables.
And I was just going to say, and we have talked in the past about kids and nature photography. I would imagine that going out and taking pictures of crops as they're on the vine or you know, otherwise coming out of the ground might be a fun thing for kids to do as well.
Yeah, there's ways to incorporate, you know, crafts into gardening and stuff. You know, it's not just the act of growing these vegetables. You know, I mean, with the seed mats, you can make little spider shaped seed mats and make that into a little activity. You can grow or make the little, like, the grow tags, you know, so when you put your labels out there, you're like, what plant is this? You know, make a little carrot out of a popsicle stick and plant that stick next to the carrots, you know, and so there's ways to kind of to add the fun to the gardening to help with just the doldrums of, you know, weeding the garden.
Well, Ken, Stacy, thanks so much as always.
Hey,
thanks.
Stacy Tornio and Ken Keffer are the minds behind the website Destination Nature and the authors of several books, the latest of which is We Love Nature, a keepsake journal for families who love to explore the outdoors, and they are regular Lake Effect contributors. We'll continue to mark National Poetry Month with the work of a Wisconsin native now living in the Southwest. That's when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Teich. We have been featuring poetry throughout April, National Poetry Month. Today we'll meet another Wisconsin poet, or at least a poet who is a Wisconsin native. She got her start in poetry when she was in middle school. Erin Larandos is a public librarian who graduated from UW-Milwaukee and now lives in the Southwest. She explains to Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson about the first time she wrote a poem.
We had a weekly writing time during one of my classes in sixth grade, and each week the teacher would put a little prompt up on the board, and then we would just have a free write for, you know, 15, 20 minutes, something like that. And one day, the prompt was to think about what it would mean to be an inch tall. And of course, you know, most people just sort of talked about how everything's taller than them and all that sort of thing. But that was actually the time that I wrote my very first poem. I wrote about, you know, what it would be to be an inch tall, and of course, the real clincher at the end was, take it from me, I am an inch tall. Really deep stuff, you know?
Yeah. So then what kind of poetry do you write? What is it, rhyming, or what do you aim for when you are writing poetry?
Most of my stuff is in, you know, a really free, non-formatic style. I do try to emulate different styles sometimes, especially if there's something new that I haven't, you know, been able to play around with. I do like writing haiku. The other style that, you know, when I'm just trying to be creative and I don't really have anything specific that I want to talk about, a style that I'll go to is called pie poetry, which of course is following the format of pi, you know, 3.14, on and on and on. Hmm. And so similar to the haiku style, you're breaking down the lines by syllables, but the first line would have three syllables, the second line would have one syllable, et cetera, et cetera. And so in theory, that poem could go on forever because
exactly.
Pi goes on forever. I actually heard about that style from kind of a random source. I follow the author Anne Rice's assistant, who is also an author. His name is Beckett, on Facebook, and he posts a lot of those. And so that's where I heard about that one, and I thought that was kind of interesting that, there's always a limit to how far you can go with a lot of other styles because there's either a certain number of lines or you have to end in a certain way, that sort of thing. But with that, you could really go on forever and ever. So that's kind of an interesting way to look at it.
I really like that there's a kind of a meaning or kind of a code behind the poetry rather than here's just a bunch of random thoughts. So that's mm-hmm. really interesting.
Yeah.
You have three different poems. So what is the first one about?
The first one I actually just wrote this week. I was sitting outside on my lunch break from the library.
Now, you're actually in Arizona as opposed to Wisconsin.
Yes. So I should mention that it's a little warmer out here. I can actually sit outside for lunch already. But I should give a little bit of background on that. Since I just recently moved out here, I got a job as a tech librarian at the Mesa Public Library in Mesa, Arizona. And if you're unfamiliar with the Phoenix area, it's one of the largest cities in the country. And so, of course, we experience a lot of homelessness and, you know, different income and, you know, different demographics than, you know, a lot of other areas. And, you know, I know, obviously, Milwaukee has those issues, too. But, you know, I grew up in the Madison area in Wisconsin, and you saw it, but you didn't see it quite as much as you see out here just because of the population density. And so the location of the library in the city of Mesa is right around a lot of the other, you know, government buildings and city buildings and whatnot. And there's a lot of open spaces where homeless people tend to congregate. And it's one thing that, you know, if you're not used to seeing it like that, it can strike you a great force. And so earlier this week, I was walking behind the library. There's a green space that's irrigated, so you can't walk through it, and then a lot of paved areas. And one of the little kind of seating areas was overtaken by this homeless man. And so as I was forcefully having to walk around this person because of his location and where I was trying to get, you know, it just kind of struck me as like, why am I so concerned about the fact that I'm walking around this guy? You know, what is that supposed to mean to me? So as I was sitting there eating my lunch, I, you know, just quick pulled out my notebook and started writing about it. And this is what came from it. So this one's a new one, so it's not quite as edited and polished as it might be, but.
So what's the call?
And I tend not to title my poems. I don't know. I just can never come up with another word or two. They say that poets are just writers who can't finish their sentences. Well, poets are also writers who don't want to have to write more than they, you know, absolutely have to.
There so, you go.
So it's not titled. How am I supposed to feel walking that extra distance around the homeless man sleeping in my way with my large soda and ice cream balanced precariously in my hand? The opposite shoulder flung with designer bag filled with books, phone, wallet. I'm sorry. I'm rushing back to my job that paid for these things, but cannot repay you.
Wow. Wow. That can really hit home, especially from the Milwaukee area.
And, you know, that was always one thing that struck me visiting Milwaukee, you know, growing up in Madison. I do have family in Milwaukee as well. And so, you know, I was there not just for school, and, you know, as soon as you get to the downtown area, there's a stark difference between that and the suburbs. And it's hard, you know, to see that when you're not used to it. That's for sure.
Definitely. So do we have another one?
We do. This one I actually wrote a few years ago when I was 26. We had just gotten married, and my husband and I were starting to consider whether or not we wanted to have kids right away or if we wanted to wait and that sort of thing. And, you know, this might be a little TMI for some people, but of course, every month when you're waiting to see if you're going to have a baby, you know, there's this certain thing that happens when you're a woman. And, you know, it started to make me think about how we think about these supposedly natural things that happen to us, and how that image of how these things are supposed to be functioning in our lives change as we go throughout our life, I guess, is the idea behind it. So this one is also untitled. At 26, it should no longer be a scare, but that terminology is stuck, lodged like a brand new embryo in my brain. I want to loose it from its mooring and send it out on a monthly flow.
So then I wonder what happened.
Well, eventually we had a child. She's a year and a half old now.
Aww.
And actually, I should say that whole, you know, thought process didn't take very long. We'd been together for quite a number of years before we got married. So the fact that we only waited 3 months to have a kid was not all that odd.
That's true.
It worked out well.
Good. All right. And then do you have one last one for us?
I do. And this one, there's really no story behind except for the story that it's telling. So it's pretty self-explanatory. For one moment, one microsecond in the darkness of midnight, I could not tell, could not decide if the sirens blared only in my mind. My ears rang for hours or minutes in the late night, blackness seeping through the windows, shrouded in a fog of sleep.
Well, Erin Larandos, you are quite the poet.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for being on our show, and we hope to have you back soon.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate being able to talk to the folks that I haven't seen for a while.
Exactly. And you can come back to Wisconsin anytime.
Okay, I will. Thank you. Yeah.
Librarian and poet Erin Larandos is a native of Verona, Wisconsin, and a graduate of UW-Milwaukee. She recently moved to Arizona with her husband and daughter and now lives outside Phoenix, where she is a librarian at the Mesa Public Library. She spoke with Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson. Lake Effect Bonnie North is with us in the studio now one more time during this Friday edition of Lake Effect to talk about our Spring Into Action membership drive. We have a goal of $700 by 11 o'clock this morning, which is just a few seconds away, and you can put us over the top. And that is by calling
414-227-3210 or going to the website wuwm.com/give. Make sure that you get in on the wonderful stainless steel tumbler with the push-on lid, the plastic liner, the foam insulation, and the WUWM logo on that. That is offered during this membership drive only for a gift of at least $60 or a sustaining membership beginning at $5 a month. So make sure you get that now and show your proud support of Milwaukee Public Radio. You'll also be entered into that drawing for a dinner for two in Chicago at the Michelin-starred Moto restaurant that includes a farm tour and a cooking class. But you got to be in it to win it. 414-227-3210, wuwm.com/give.
And, of course, when you are supporting us at WUWM, you are supporting our local programming like Lake Effects and WUWM at night, as well as the national programming you rely on every day, from Fresh Air, which comes your way next, to shows like Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Car Talk. That's all for the Friday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite. Great to have you listening today, and I sure hope you'll join us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. 414-227-3210 or wuwm.com/give. Thanks so much. It's 11 o'clock.